Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And joining us to talk about this case is the author of a new book, and she's been on the show before. And the book is Velvely Dickinson, and the author is Barbara Casey. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm glad to be here.
It's funny. I get the name wrong after I practice it.
Well, it's an unusual name. It really is. As much as I have read about and researched and all, I still stumble, so... Don't feel bad. It isn't your common variety Mary.
No, I know, and that's kind of, that really draws you to it. It did me. I mean, right away it was like, Velvely. Wow. I've never come across that before. So what drew you to it? Is the name, too, got you into writing this book?
Well, actually, when I was on your show before, we talked about my book about Catherine Kelly, who was Machine Gun Kelly's wife and also the brains behind all of their illegal activities. And when I was doing research on Catherine, I came across Velvely because they were both in the same prison at the same time. And so I just made a mental note that once I finished my book on Catherine Kelly, I wanted to go back and check into Velvely to find out what her story was. And that took me on this journey because it was difficult. Like Catherine, there was just so very little known about Velvely, and yet she played this huge, major part in American history during World War II. So that it was quite a story. It was quite a journey.
Yeah, I mean, in the short of it, she was actually a spy for the Japanese government during the war times, I guess.
She was an American. She was born in Sacramento, California. Her parents were both born in the United States, so they were of German descent, but they were all Americans. But she was an American woman, and yet she was spying for the Japanese imperial government.
Wow.
Against the United States, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. And just for the young listeners, you got to realize that back in those days, communication was not real simple. It's not like you could just call someone, or even on a regular phone, even a landline, never mind cell phones and computers. So How was someone like her, all American, indoctrinated, or how did she get into that?
You know, it's there seems to have been some sort of interest, even as a young child, because when she was in high school, she wanted to learn the language of Japanese. She studied it, and she was seemed to be drawn to that culture. And then as a young woman, she graduated from Stanford, and she the work that she went into took her into close proximity with the Japanese, the Imperial Valley there in California, and eventually she was married and divorced twice, which was very unusual for a woman at during that time. So she was sort of a free spirit already. But as a young girl, she was interested in Japanese culture, and she tried to learn everything about it. When she married the third time, her husband had a food brokerage company located in the Imperial Valley. So that exposed her to all kinds of the Japanese culture and the different societies she joined and insisted that her husband join. And she started even dressing in authentic Japanese attire. She really did love the Japanese culture.
Wow. Now Velvely was known as what they call the doll woman.
The doll woman.
Yeah.
Right.
How did that come about? Like, why did she get that nickname?
She, at the age of 41, started collecting dolls. She and her husband had no children, and by then, his company had gone broke, and so they had moved to New York, and to New York City. And she started collecting dolls, rare and antique, and foreign dolls primarily. And she had this real genius for marketing. She started selling dolls to people who were maybe searching for a specific antique doll, and she started writing articles and journals that focused on doll collecting, and then eventually she opened her own doll shop on Madison Avenue. So she became well known throughout not only the United States but in Europe, because she was constantly dealing with other doll collectors around the world, acquiring dolls for her own shop. So that's how she became known as the Doll Woman. But then it took a bitter turn, because eventually she started using her knowledge of dolls and doll collecting to promote her spying
yeah.
effort.
What kind of dolls was she collecting, and what kind of doll shop? Like, what kind of dolls were they? Like, specialty?
Primarily antique and rare dolls. Back then, and even today, doll collecting is one of the biggest hobbies that there is. But back then, especially, it was the women who collected dolls. Some men, but very few children. It was mostly adults that were interested in doll collecting. So Velvely had an enormous collection of rare dolls and dolls from she boasted from every country in the world, and also antique dolls. In fact, she would go and to different conferences and talk as an expert on dolls. And one of her dolls was from the 1700s, a wooden doll, and it was even pictured in the New York Times. So she was really well known throughout the United States and the world as an expert on dolls and doll collecting, but in particular the rare and antique and the foreign dolls. And in her shop, she had a beautiful shop. It was right on Madison Avenue. A big storefront window, and her dolls, the least expensive dolls, were around $15. But the rare ones and the beautiful antique ones would maybe she could get thousands of dollars for one doll. So she really had a business there. And this is so unusual because you have to remember it was pre-war and war, so people just didn't have that kind of money.
Yeah, because this is the 1930s?
This was late 1930s and early 1940s, right before Pearl Harbor.
Wow, and that's a lot of money back then, even $15.
Oh, it is.
You know.
Yeah, it is. And but her clients, she catered to the wealthy, and movie stars, politicians, just people who had who were wealthy in spite of the threat of war and that kind of thing. So she had a high clientele. She
wow.
did a lot of traveling back and forth between New York and California, and that was why she built up a lot of clients within Hollywood there. So she knew what she was doing.
She must have been in good standing then, and she must have had a good amount of money to be able to just travel and open a shop and do all this doll trading.
She had to have been making good money on her sales. Her husband took care of the bookkeeping, and her brother, who was the only sibling she had, he was 11 years younger than she. He would tend the shop when she was traveling, doing all this traveling. And of course, once the war started, travel was almost impossible for the civilians. Everything was reserved for the military, and yet she, Velva Lee, and her husband, Lee, could travel back and forth at will. And remember when in the society pages they used to always talk about which Hollywood star was visiting where, what they were doing, where they were traveling and all. That's how they treated Velva Lee. She would go on these trips to the West Coast, and it would be written up in the newspapers and the society pages. That was how well-known she was.
Kind of like a celebrity, really.
Yes, she was. She was.
Wow. So now she actually started using these dolls in her espionage, we say, in her spying. How did she do that? Like,
well, it was the earliest witness report that she was perhaps working with the Japanese was when a witness saw a Japanese man dressed in military officer uniform enter her shop and give her a packet. And it was later discovered that that packet had $20,000 in it. This was like 2 days before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And what Velva Lee was, as I had mentioned earlier, she was a genius at marketing. And one thing that she was very good at was corresponding with all of her clients. She had at this time over 20,000 clients, and she would write to all of them, and they telling them about some of her latest acquisitions and a special doll that she had gotten or whatever. And then they would respond, also corresponding. Sometimes they would want to buy the doll, but often they felt like they had a friend in her more than anything else, and they would tell her things about their private lives and what was going on, and she would take that information, and she wrote five letters. In the end, it came out that there were five letters that we know of. And she was writing them and using her clients' names. She picked out five different women that she had corresponded with. She threw in some personal information in the letter, but the letter itself was coded in something called an open code. And then she signed it using almost the same signature as what the client had used, and used their return address on the envelope. And she sent those letters to a woman in Buenos Aires, and who was the Japanese contact. That the letters were then supposed to be turned over to the Japanese imperial government. But the letters, if they were examined by the Postal Service, they looked innocent enough. They talked about doll collecting and dolls and then that personal information about whatever they were doing. So, but how she got tripped up was the FBI discovered the woman in Buenos Aires, and they had already arrested her. So when the first letter was sent to Buenos Aires, there was no one there to receive it, and so it was returned. And it, because it had the return address of one of her clients, it went to that client. And she, when she opened it and read it, it just didn't make sense to her. She understood some of the information because it was her personal information, but the other things just didn't make sense. And what is, because it was coded, it was, Beverly was using words like balloons and nets, fishing nets and things like that, to describe battleships and where they were and where they were being repaired and where they were being discharged and so forth. And so this, the first letter, known as the Springfield letter, got turned over to the FBI, and that started the investigation.
Hmm. Now, do we know how she got involved with this scheme, sort of? Like what, do we know what drew her in, as in, not so much that, like, who contacted her, who got her in initially, but do you know why she wanted to do this?
You know, that's such a good question, because every book that I've written, and you know, like Catherine Kelly, who knows what drove her, except it was just the thrill of excitement of doing things that were illegal. And with Velva Lee, I think most people come down on the fact that she was greedy. But I go back to when she was a young girl and when she wanted to study the Japanese language and how she enjoyed dressing up in the Japanese attire. I'm not sure. I'm just not. But in her defense, during this time, her husband Lee was very ill. He had had several heart attacks, and he had something called Bright's disease, which weakened his heart, and yet he was still doing this traveling with her. But the medical bills were piling up. He needed nursing care around the clock. She had help at the home to a maid, and then she was trying to run her shop. And then doing all that traveling still. So, you know, she had tremendous bills. And so a lot of people think that perhaps it was because of that that she decided to become a spy.
I just find it strange because, like, if I'm in general, you know, if someone's just in need of making more money to pay more bills, that's not the first thing you think of. I mean,
no, it isn't. And I think and the other reason too, she was in a position where she was an easy contact for the Japanese because she was familiar with the language and because she was so familiar with their culture and because she belonged to all these organizations, societies that were for the Japanese. She was easy to approach. She entertained many of the ranking military officers in her home, and it's just, she was an easy target, and she was a willing target.
Wow. Now, what kind of information was she actually passing on to the Japanese? What exactly was she giving them?
Well, the most important information came right after the Pearl Harbor bombing, and the Japanese seemed to be particularly interested in how much damage had been done, which battleships were being repaired and where, and where were they being recommissioned. And she had all that information. She was still traveling to the West Coast, And she was invited by many of the wives of our military officers, the naval officers, and they would have a little tea party, and they discussed dolls and over tea. But while she was there, because they were the wives of naval officers, she would innocently ask them about what was going on and which ships were there and how fascinating it was, and you know, just into the normal conversation. And so she got a lot of information that way. And then the other way was, there was this realtor that she used whenever she'd go to California, and he would just show for her to the different seaports where the ships were actually being repaired. And so she could visually see what was being done. And she would talk to the local people in the different little shops and all, and the realtor. And no one even suspected, though, that she was a spy. Here's this little woman who collected dolls and, you know, just interested in what was going on in world events. And yet she was collecting information. And that was the information that she was passing on to the Japanese in those coded letters.
Wow. And so that returned letter being turned into the FBI is what got their attention about her.
That's right. That got their attention. And then within just a short period of time, four more letters were returned also and turned into the FBI. So they knew that there was some... They started their formal investigation, and they the one thing that these five women had in common that had turned in the letters was that with Velva Lee. They had at some time had all corresponded with Velva Lee, and so she had their signatures and information about their private lives. And so from that point on, they started following Velva Lee and surveilling her. And they did this for well over a year, because they wanted to make sure that they knew what they were doing, that they were correct in their assumptions.
So they arrested her finally.
Yeah, but what was so funny in their surveillance, here are these FBI agents, and probably, you know, they might be a little different today, but not much. But they'd be all dressed up in their suits, and they'd go into her doll shop, like pretending like they were shopping for dolls, and they would ask her questions. And of course, that was a dead giveaway, because their questions weren't intelligent. And she knew right away, well, you know, these aren't doll collectors. Why are they hanging around in my shop? But still, they persisted in gathering information and intel on her. Velva Lee was less than 5 feet tall, and she weighed less than 100 pounds. She was just a little woman, and she started suspecting that she was being followed, and she started to panic. And she considered a lot of different things, like moving to Canada or moving to Mexico, or she couldn't understand why her sources weren't sending her more money. This was a constant theme in some of her correspondence. And eventually she decided she needed to get out of there, because that she felt like that she was going to be arrested. And so she went to her bank, and where she had a safety deposit box. And when she went into the room and unlocked her safety deposit box, two FBI agents had followed her, and they immediately arrested her. Well, here's this little bitty woman. She threw the safety deposit box at them and started kicking and screaming and clawing and batting them over the head with her pocketbook. And, I mean, she was a handful, and it took both of those men to physically carry her out of that bank and in front of all the bank personnel and the people that had gone to do their business. And so here they came, but that was how she was arrested. And she kept denying that she had done nothing wrong, and she kept with that story throughout. She never did admit that she had ever done anything wrong.
Wow. But now, do you think her family was involved? Like, her husband traveled with her all the time. So, do you think he knew about what was going on?
He was bound to have known, but he was so ill at that time that there really wasn't anything he could do. And she was, I think she was just a real strong-willed woman. And she had decided that that was the direction she was going to take. And I have to give her credit. She stayed with that husband. And even though it was draining everything that they had worked for financially, she stayed with him, even though she had already been divorced twice. So I think she must have felt some love for him, but she just went about it the wrong way to try to fix their financial problems. I think he probably knew, and I'm sure her brother knew.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
By then, her parents were dead, so it was just the three of them. But that her brother did try to help her, and he got into trouble for it. This was after the trial and after she had been sentenced to prison. But she was sentenced, or she was charged with espionage, which was the death penalty by electric chair, and also for violating the wartime censorship laws. And the lawyer who was the prosecutor was a man who had a 98% conviction record. And
no.
And yeah, it is pretty good, McNally. And he had even convicted a woman who had taught her parrot to say Heil Hitler. And and she had her citizenship revoked because of that. So he was a tough guy, he really was. And that's who Belva Lee was facing. And as they got deeper into what evidence they had, all the things that the FBI had come up with, and the cryptologist who had deciphered the letters and all of that, he was afraid that because Beverly kept insisting that it was her husband who had been the spy, not her, that she didn't know anything about it, that she had only typed the letters as he had dictated, but she didn't know what they meant. He was afraid, and because she was a woman, that the evidence was too circumstantial and that he might not be able to get a guilty plea for the espionage. So they worked a plea deal, and they dropped the charge of espionage but kept the violation of the censorship laws, which that took off the death penalty. But at the end of the trial, the judge wasn't believing her story that it was her husband, and he had no sympathy, and he gave her the maximum sentence, which was 10 years in Alderson Women's Correctional Institution and $10,000 fine.
Wow. And wow. So now she served out her time in prison then, and she got out?
Well, not really. She had so many good things going for her, and it was just such a shame that she took such a dark turn in her life, because she could have accomplished so much with all of her ability and she was an intelligent woman. But about three years after she had been serving her time, Eunice Kennedy, who was the sister of our president, John Kennedy. She went to Alderson, where Velvely was serving out her sentence. She was doing some research on how to help women who had been in prison adjust to life after they were released. And Eunice was another real strong woman, and she believed that most of the women who had been sentenced to prison were there because of a man in their life, either their husband or a boyfriend or a abusive father or something like that. And for some reason, now this is during the time when Beverly was at Alderson, there was, of course, Catherine Kelly was there, Axis Sally, Tokyo Rose. They were all serving time at this same women's prison. And for some reason, Eunice took a special interest in Beverly, and she started working with her, and they became quite good friends, apparently. And Beverly was released from prison 3 years early. There was no announcement or anything like that. She was just quietly released, and I feel that Eunice probably had something to do with that. Beverly returned to New York, where she had a job waiting for her. Again, this was because of Eunice. And she worked through the Catholic Church for a while, and then within a short time became Eunice's private secretary.
Well, that would be a good job.
Wouldn't be too bad, would it?
No.
Beverly attended the wedding of Eunice and Sergeant Shriver, and she was in the reception line, and I mean, she was like part of a family there for a while. Then she just disappeared. After that, she just sort of disappeared. It was like she just didn't want anyone to know about her past or what she was doing now.
Wow. What do you think happened to her? Like, where did you think she went?
I think she probably stayed in New York because that was her last home. Her doll shop, her brother sold her dolls and her doll shop when she was still in prison. So she didn't have that anymore. And I'm really not sure how she made her money because... unless she was able to save quite a bit from what Eunice paid her. I think maybe eventually there were rumors that people would still see her dressed in Japanese attire visiting the Japanese society that she was had been a member of for all those years. But that was never substantiated. But still, it makes you wonder. Everything about her just seems to have just disappeared. The only record I was able to find was a mention that she died in 1980, and she probably would have been about 87 then. But even after that, people were still reporting that they had seen this elderly American woman dressed in Japanese attire attending that Nippon Club in New York. So it's just hard to say. I know her parents were buried in California in a old cemetery there, but she's not buried there. I checked all the records and I checked the plots and all, but she isn't there. So her brother wound up in Pennsylvania. He finally got married. And so it's just hard to know what happened to Velva Lee.
And so did her brother just lose contact with her, or did he, her brother didn't know anything?
I think while she was in prison, he several times tried to give her these notebooks that she was asking him to give her. And I believe that those notebooks probably had the different Japanese contacts that she had been working with, and she was going to try to contact them and get some money from them. But there was always an FBI agent present whenever he was visiting his sister. And so he'd been warned several times not to try to touch her, not try to give her any information. And when he kept trying to do it, he wound up going to jail for 10 days. And the judge told him that he could no longer visit Velva Lee. But he rescinded that after he served his 10 days and let him visit her. But I think by then he realized that there was nothing he could do for her anymore, that and he went on his own and apparently met someone and got married and moved to Pennsylvania. So I think he just moved on with his life. And I know that Velva Lee wrote to him several times, and he did write back. But mostly she was asking him to bring her things, of maybe books or personal things. But I don't think they kept that close contact they had had when she had the doll shop.
Now I see after she got out of prison, she actually changed her name to Catherine Dickerson.
She did. And again, that was just another indication that she was trying she just didn't want people to know what she had done. Not that you can blame her. You don't want people to know you've been in prison for spying.
Right.
And so she changed her name and tried to move on. And certainly she had a good step forward by being Eunice's private secretary. But I'm not sure why Eunice, if she just let her go after so long, or Beverly just moved on, I just don't know. Beverly did make one more contact with Eunice, and she would have been about 70 at this time. And they were having the World's Fair there in New York, and she was wanting to work at the World's Fair. But then she found out that they were doing background checks on all the people that they were going to hire. And she contacted Eunice to find out if she could do something where they wouldn't do a background check on her. She was afraid they'd find out that she'd been in prison. And there is no correspondence from Eunice about that, whether she helped or not. That was the last contact they had.
Wow. Quite a story.
It is. It is. The amazing thing is that it's been hidden for so long. you know, I had to go through the FBI vault and the Freedom of Information Act to get what information I could from the FBI. But it was just, at the time, it was an enormous story. I mean, it was all over the world. Newspapers all over the world were following this story, what was going to happen to Beverly Dickinson, the doll woman spy. And because she just had so many contacts from her days of running the doll shop.
Wow. And now, what happened to her husband that was ill? Did he just die when she was in prison?
He died before she was arrested. So that was why she felt she could say that he was the spy, not her. He died a few months before she was arrested. But there were people that refuted that her story, that he was the spy, because she claimed that that packet of $20,000, you know, that the Japanese military officer gave her, she had said that he had given it to her husband and that he had hidden it under the mattress. But he had a full-time nurse and a full-time maid, and they both denied that there was ever any money under the mattress, and that he physically wasn't able to go to the shop to meet anyone at that time. So, you know, her story, she tried to blame her husband because he was dead and couldn't defend himself, but yet many people just never did believe it.
And so now she was a pretty smart woman, right? Didn't she go for a degree at Stanford?
She did, and also that was where Eunice Kennedy went to college. So they shared that. Beverly was by then quite a bit older than Eunice. I think she was about maybe 20 years older than Eunice. But still, they both attended Stanford, and they both, Beverly, when she first got out of college, was interested in working in social welfare, and especially helping the Japanese. And of course, Eunice Kennedy was always involved in social welfare, not necessarily the Japanese, but the women, helping them improve their lives and that kind of thing. So they had that thing in common. But yes, they'll believe her at that age, at that time, for her to go to college and graduate. And of course, with they'll believe, there's always a fly in the ointment, because even when she supposedly graduated from Stanford, she didn't actually receive her degree for 11 years. And the reason is because, supposedly, she failed to return some library books she had checked out. So they didn't give her her degree until she returned those books.
Well...
Yes, she was intelligent.
Yeah, I guess. Now, and I noticed her name, her name before marriage, Valvely Malvina Blucher?
Yes.
Wow. Where is that from? Like, what do we know what that name?
That's German. That was the German descent. Both her father and her mother had parents from Germany, even though they were born in the United States. But yeah, that was some call it Bluhar. They pronounce it Bluhar, but most people will say it's Blucher. And her father was I think a car mechanic. In fact, that was how he died. He was crushed in a car wheel when he was 61 years old. And her mother was from Kentucky, rural background. And she died at also very young, at 46, of tuberculosis. So, but the family on both sides had German ancestors, and that's where that name comes from.
So that must have really devastated what family was around, or even the neighbors and the friends or people she knew.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, and you know it's typical because. As long as Beverly was at her peak, you know, speaking all around the country and giving lectures and being the expert on to be called about any question about a doll, People really respected her, and they paid her money for everything that she was doing. But of course, once she went to prison, all of that changed, and neighbors started talking about, well, she really wasn't an attractive woman. She was mousy, and she wore brown all the time, and they started being very negative toward her at that time. So I think it's just part of the human condition to be that way, but I think Eunice apparently saw something good in her, and she really tried to reach out and help her. And I'm wondering if, because Eunice was so adamant about believing most women were in prison because of some male influence, I just wonder if she didn't believe Beverly's story that it was her husband, Lee, who had been the spy and not Beverly, and she felt compassionate toward her because of that. I don't know. But she certainly reached out and gave her every opportunity.
Wow. Now, did she have any children with any of these husbands?
No children. Nope. And which might have been a reason why she started doll collecting to begin with. But the story goes that a friend gave her two Filipino dolls. They were folk dolls. And when she was 41 years old, and she was just so taken by the dolls that those two dolls that she decided to start her own collection, and that's what she did.
Wow,
I
was going to say, when she got fined that $10,000 in 10 years, how did she come up with the $10,000, or do you think she had it?
Well, she did in the safety deposit box. I think there was over close to $40,000 in there. Yeah. And plus a lot of bonds and certificates and all. And all of them could be traced back to the Imperial Japanese government. And, I mean, it was just, the evidence was there. And the IRS immediately stepped in and took all of the money that she had, saying that she owed it in back taxes. And so from somewhere that $10,000 came out of that, I suppose, but she was left penniless by the time it was over with.
Wow. Just crazy. what a life.
The trial, here the FBI agents had been following her for over a year before they decided to go ahead and arrest her. And the trial took 7 months, and through the entire thing, Beverly never admitted that she had done anything wrong. And she, through the whole thing, she just, every time she could cause a scene, she did. She was just a little fighter. That's all there was to it. She just refused to accept that she had been caught. And in fact, she mentioned to someone that she just never thought she would be caught, and that in itself was revealing that she was guilty. But wow!
I'm just seeing that the buying power of $40,000 in 1940.
Oh, my goodness!
That would be worth $700,000 today.
Well, it was a lot. And at the time, and no telling how much she had already spent, because she was considered the highest paid American spy during the World War II. And it's interesting because during that time, especially after the Pearl Harbor, the fear and paranoia of the Japanese was already starting to boil, but when Pearl Harbor happened, it was, and the internment camps, all of that, it was just, the paranoia was just widespread, and there was only one person known to have successfully passed military information to the Imperial Japanese government following Pearl Harbor, and that was Belva Lee. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I, you know, I think it's a crazy, crazy.
It's hard to believe that one woman could have done so much, but she did. And the information that she passed on, if it had gotten into the Japanese hands, it could have done a great deal more damage. What they don't know is, was she able to pass on any information before those five letters? They say they don't think so. They think that was it. But who knows? Because she was still getting paid before Pearl Harbor. So she had to get her, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Wow. That's quite a story. So now, have you got a website or your own personal site that people can go to, or do they have to get the book through Amazon and stores?
Well, it's available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and your local favorite store that can be ordered. I do have a website. I don't sell my books on my website, but my website is BarbaraCaseyAgency.com. And I have all of my books listed there with descriptions if anyone's interested.
Wow.
But the books are available, and also in Kindle and Nook and hard copy, paperback.
So, yeah. Now, so what have you got planned next? Are you working on another kind of history crime? Or?
Well, my last three books have been nonfiction about women like Delva Lee and Catherine Kelly and Asaba Shakur was my most recent one, and besides Delva Lee. And so before that, I was a novelist, and so I turned back to a novel, and I want to get this one out of my system. And once I complete this novel that I'm working on now, then I'm probably going to go back to nonfiction, because I just really enjoy doing the research. It's hard work, but when you discover things that you know no one else has seen, and it's going to be such an interesting story, it's hard to turn your back on it, and so that's what my plan is.
Well, that sounds good. And actually, we'll have your book up on our website as well. People can just do one click and pick up the book if they listen to the show, and it's fascinating. We'll also put a link to your website for them. And
thank you.
Again, the book, Valva Lee Dickinson. And our author on board today has been Barbara Casey. Thank you for doing the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.